Accession number 9752, reel 9.
Colonel Dillon, reel 9. Before we move on from when you were wounded and treated in England, I'd like to discuss a few points that we've been discussing off the tape and which we can now bring in. If you'd like to continue.
I'd like to make a slight correction here, because when I joined B Battalion, the Heavy Branch Machine Gun Corps, I was posted to B Company and not C. I'd just like to keep the record straight. When we were in this area in B Battalion near St. Paul, in actual fact, a good deal of training was going on of a rather amateur nature, because the only instructors available were the crews of the original tanks which went into action the previous September. However, training of the sort went on. There was driving and maintenance, gunnery, use of pigeons, gas, and reconnaissance officers training. That went on locally and at Merlimont, the Trepoix, and Erin, various villages around, and various villages around St. Paul. One thing that one battalion tried to do was to train their crews to work in a confined space. And as the supply of tanks was extremely limited, only two or three at that time to each company, canvas screens carried by four men with another four inside, a sort of mobile public lavatory were provided, and these were carried with the men inside. They were to walk across country, which they did, but of course they couldn't see exactly where they were going, and it was a hilarious job to watch these creatures going across country, knowing full well that the bump of ground which we and the spectators could see would inevitably bring about a disaster. And sure enough, it happened. No damage was done, but much amusement was had by all. As regards the...
Just a couple of points. How much of this training did you personally undergo? We've discussed that you did the reconnaissance officer part, but I think before you thought you hadn't done much else of the training. Did you in fact do more of this into driving and such like and signalling?
I did a machine gun course on the Vickers, because until then the only machine gun knowledge I had was the Lewis gun, but I went on a gas training as well as a reconnaissance course.
What was the taking the machine gun first? What did that training course involve?
Pulling the thing to pieces and putting it together in the dark, and naturally I was shooting it, and training in clearing stoppages. That was the most important thing of it.
The clearing stoppages.
Clearing stoppages, of which there were plenty.
What about the shooting? Were you just taught the level of shooting you needed to know from a tank, or were you taught about the sophistications of barrage and firing, deflection, firing, anything like that?
No, very primitive, only what was required to work the gun in the tank itself.
And what was the gas course consisting of?
A very short course. It consisted of learning how to wear your respirator. Then you had drill in going through into a room where there was gas, where you had to put your respirator on without breathing. A lot of people used to panic and dig a deep breath of gas and have to be put out through the emergency exit. But it wasn't a very difficult course. It was rather a couple of days more than a course. But it was very necessary, because people who were freshly out from England had never experienced gas at all. And so they had to be given a certain amount of confidence in their gas helmets.
Did you have any trouble getting your helmet on during the test?
No, no trouble at all. It was quite a simple matter, really, when you came to think of it.
Did you mention the use of shovels? Could you explain that?
Well, that was a primitive method of communication. We had no method of signalling, although some semaphore signals were tried, but of course they all got shot away. And really, the only sensible way of communication with our infantry was to open the lid at the top of the tank and push up a shovel if we had conquered the objective and it was time for the infantry to come and take over, so they could come and dig in, hence the shovel. And that worked quite well.
Was there any other?
As far as connection with your headquarters was concerned, the only communication there were two pigeons which were carried in each tank. They didn't always do very well, because the poor pigeons used to get overcome with the heat and smell of the tank. One very kindly tank commander, who was a friend of mine, fed his pigeons on little bits of CD cake which he had in his tank and moistened them with whiskey. And the result was that when his tank got stuck on a tree root, and he tried to send the pigeon off to say where he was, he pushed the pigeon out through a revolver port onto the top of the track, and it sat there. Obviously wasn't going to leave the source of such nectar and fly off. So the driver said, "It's all right, sir, I'll start that track, and the track will go round, and the pigeon will fall off when it comes to the front." So he started the track running with the pigeon hanging into that nonsense. It strode out manfully and kept position where it was, to the side of the revolver port. No amount of poking with a stick or anything would shift it. So he never got his pigeon away. However, another tank came along and came to his rescue. That was one of the troubles with tree roots. They would get stuck under the bottom of the tank and press up against the bottom plating, which pressed again on the flywheel of the engine and stopped it. So you either got a stopped engine, or else you got a position where you were suspended on the tree root and the tanks went round quite freely, but you did not move.
These methods of communication, was there any method of communicating from one tank to another by any of these signal methods, with a shovel or with anything else? Or were there any other messages you could pass to the infantry that were accepted or known using the shovel?
No, as far as I can remember, we had no other method of communication. Flags and semaphore have been tried, but they were all a dismal failure.
Were you trained at all in how to get the tanks out of various unpleasant situations? You know, using the experience of these early... of the early tank crews, who must have found themselves in some peculiar situations, would they give you advice on how to get off a tree trunk, how to get out of a deep trench and such like?
Yes. I don't think it was a matter that was gone into very deeply, because it was so obvious. If you were stuck on a tree trunk, well, it's quite obvious you had to get somebody to tow you clear and so on. If you got stuck in very deep mud, again there was nothing else but to get a tow out. Later on in the war we got a splendid device, which was a large oak beam carried on the roof, and if you got stuck you could attach this oak beam to each track, one on each side of the tank, and when the tracks moved it would pull this beam over the front of the tank and fall onto the ground, and the chains would then hold when the tracks gripped, and the tank would pull itself out of any ground in which the engine would run.
Were they using fascines by then, the bundles of wood?
The fascines you mentioned were bundles of wood which were carried on the top of the nose of the tank. And they were very large bundles. They were 4 or 5 feet in diameter. The object was to drop them into a very deep trench so that the tank could drop its nose onto them and climb up the other side. Whereas without that filling, as it were, of the trench, the tank would not have been able to take it. And that was how we were able to cross the Hindenburg line, which was made specially deep to prevent it being crossed by tanks.
Had these come into use by this time, when you were at St. Paul?
No.
So these were for the future?
They were very much in the future.
I believe also you have some comments and opinions on the generals.
Do you like to hear my ideas on the subject of generals in World War One? They were very much the prototype of the music hall brigadier general. There was one chap who's Brigadier General Armstrong, who came on me as I was drilling my platoon at Halton Park before breakfast. And he saw these men, most of whom had holes in their trousers or their shirts sticking out. They'd all come in civilian clothes. No uniforms had been provided. They were still in them. And he tore a strip off me and said, "Why don't you get your men uniforms? They're all in the quartermaster stores. We've only got to go in and get them." And he stamped off in a rage, having vented his spleen on me. Of course there were no uniforms. We didn't get any for another month. It is just an example of getting rid of an early morning liver. Then there was the divisional. Before we got to the divisional commander, I got my own back on this chap, because the brigade order was promulgated saying that there should be no compliments paid on training. And I took this literally. And one day we were returning from training, marching down the road, and there was the brigadier sitting on his horse by the roadside. So I took no notice. I should have given him, I was right. So I took no notice because we were on training. So he shouted for me, he said, "Hey, come here, young chap. Why didn't you give me, I was right?" So I said, "Brigade order, sir, no compliments to be paid on training." "Oh," he said, "I shall report you to your commanding officer." But he never did. The fact is that I double-crossed him and he was angry. But they are it was a bit unfair to harass a young officer, untrained and untrained men. And the same thing happened in the case of the divisional commander, Major General Hutton. He was sitting by the roadside waiting to be saluted.
In England as well?
In England as well. And as I went by, he hauled me out and said, "Hi, come here. What did your men have for breakfast?" Because I didn't know. I hadn't been to men's breakfast. It wasn't my job. It was the orderly officer's job to go around to men's breakfast. And so he said, "Well, you ought to know. How are you going to look after men if you don't know what they have for breakfast?" And dismissed me. I went back to my platoon. My men were damned angry. They were muttering and cursing about a bloody general. I didn't see him around the cookhouse and so on.
These were public dressing downs then?
Oh yes,
the men
public,
could hear.
Yeah. Oh yes, the men could hear. Which was very bad, and it's against all army regulations and training. And you never reprove anybody in front of his juniors, because it's very bad for morale and discipline.
Did you have any further contacts with generals when you actually got to France with your troops?
No, in France things are very much different, because all the stage, the music hall stage generals, like Armstrong and Hutton, had been left behind in England, and the generals then were younger men, especially when you got down to what then became brigadiers. And there were brigadiers as young as 23 and 24, and they were actually taking part in the battle in Dhaka. It's in the reserve line, and they were the only generals I've ever seen in the trenches. Haig, of course, never came near the battle, nor any of his big people. They all walked about in shiny field boots and breeches. It was after, when the war was over, and the fighting had ceased, one of his chief of staff went up to the Ypres salient, where he'd never been before, and he remarked to the chap who took him, "Good God," he said, "did we send men to fight in that?" Looking at the mud. But that was the only touch, only connection I had with the generals in France.
Right. Getting back to the chronological order of things, rather than thematic, then.
Yes.
You'd been hit. You had your cheekbone broken by a piece of shrapnel.
Yes.
How were you treated in the immediate aftermath of that? You say you were at the reserve battalion's first aid post. What did they give proper treatment, or did they just? What did they do?
Oh, they merely stuck a field dressing on my face, and I walked off. I was walking wounded, you see, I was able to walk all right, and I reached the, wherever it was, the next point of departure, and then was put into a train for Boulogne and shipped across the channel to England.
This was often called a blighty wound, and not a serious wound, but which got you sent back to United Kingdom.
It was indeed, yes. I didn't want to be sent back to the United Kingdom, but it did happen. It was quite a nasty cut. It was a piece of shell nose about the size of a 50 pence piece, much thicker. And they made more mess of my face cutting it out than they did the shell going in.
So you didn't share this enthusiasm for blighty wounds that some people in the trenches had? You would rather have stayed in France.
I would rather have stayed in France. You see, I was practically a schoolboy when I joined the army, and I had made a niche for myself in society. I'd made friends in the regiment. I knew what had happened if I was posted home. I'd be there a month or two, and I'd be posted out again. And needless to say, I'd go to somewhere different. I'd have to start all over again.
How long were you in the United Kingdom? Just
about 3 months altogether.
Which hospital were you attached to?
I first of all was sent to Lady Mount Garrett's private hospital in Park Lane, or Park Street, I forget which, and which was run by her privately, by her own expense, her own money, with all the best Harley Street surgeons. And unfortunately it was closed down, and I was sent from there I think I went up to Stirling to a convalescent home, and from then I went on leave, and then joined from there to the depot at Bovington.
What reception did you get on leave as a wounded soldier returned from the front, so to speak?
People are always very kind. If you had the blue badge on your arm, people would make way for you and cinema queues and so on.
The blue badge meaning?
Wounded. You were a blue arm badge. Convalescing soldier.
So what happened when you were sent to Bovington?
Bovington, I was sent to the depot, which was housed in wood huts. Quite a number of people there. There was absolutely nothing to do. We used to go on route marches, keep exercised. It was very boring.
Was there any more training with tanks at this point?
No. There weren't enough tanks to provide the instruction. As far as I can remember, nothing went on at Bovington except physical training and games and route marches and so on.
Was there any discussion between the officers there about the possibilities of tanks and the tactics that you might use, or were you not? Was that not a mess topic?
It wasn't a mess topic, and it was far too highbrow really for any of us to indulge in that sort of strategic and tactical talk. In fact, what I think what you're thinking about is the movement of tanks as they became 50 years later fast moving things going across country. We're dealing with tanks whose movement across country was 1 mile an hour, and so there's no question of tactical or strategical moving there at all.
How long were you at Bovington?
I think about 6 weeks.
So that would bring you up to round about June 1917?
Just about, yes.
And what happened to you then?
I was sent to France with a draft for the depot in France. I took them across, and we disembarked, I think, in Boulogne, and handed my draft over to the depot, wherever it was there, and with a complete lack of discipline, I sought out my old battalion and went and joined it.
Who were you meant to be joining?
I was meant to stay at the depot and be posted from there to somewhere else.
Would you have gone to the tanks again?
Oh, it was all tanks.
But you wouldn't have got to B come.
I wouldn't have got back to B battalion. I mean, well, in the luck of the draw that I would not have done.
So what happened when you rejoined B Company? How did you square this up with your commanding officer?
Well, telegrams started arriving asking where I was. And fortunately, Captain Hotblack, who was the chief reconnaissance officer of the heavy branch machine gun corps, knew about me as one of the reconnaissance officers he'd been training, and he was so amazed that anybody would want to come back to France and, as you might say, desert to France instead of away from it, that he managed to pull strings and get me reposted. So there I was back in B battalion, and I got my job back and my motorcycle.
Where were B Company, B Battalion, when you joined them?
When I rejoined them, they were again at Pyrmont. And I was there for a short time when I was sent to take part in a demonstration with a view to being employed of an attack on the sea wall at somewhere near Ostend. And this, at Erin, which is one of the villages nearby, there was a mock-up of the seawall done in concrete. And the tanks had to come off the sea from landing craft, crawl over the sand, and climb up the seawall. Well, this was a very difficult thing to do because the seawall was, as I say, made of concrete. It had a steep slope for about 20 feet, very steep slope, and then there was a berm or edge, as you might call it, jutting out, half rounded, above it. So the purpose, of course, being to break the force of the waves and stop them at the very top. So the interesting thing was to watch the tank tackle this, and the tank was provided with a wooden framework or crib which it pushed in front of it up the slope, and the tank got a grip on the slope which it normally couldn't have done because it had affixed to its tracks slabs of wood with steel spikes in them. These steel spikes dug into the cement and enabled the tank to crawl up. Now, by the time the tank had reached the top, which is at a pretty steep angle, Then the crib reached as far as it must go, which was under the edge of this lip which stuck out. It was shaped so that it would do so. The next thing was that the tank started to crawl up on the crib, which is pushed in front of it, rather like a baby chimp being crawled over by its mother. However, the spuds on the bottom of the crib bit into the cement, and the spikes on the bottom of the tank bit into the crib. And so it crawled up, up and up and up. And when it got to the top, as far as it could go, before it toppled over onto the ground, the driver was literally lying on his back. And it was extremely brave thing to do, I think, for the driver. So it was perfectly possible to surmount those concrete coastal defences in that manner. And in the same way, lorries were pulled up, again with the rope, and again over the crib.
What was your role in this?
Well, I was going to be one of those of the party who were going to take part in this attack. And there was a separate company was formed with a view to doing so. And I was allotted to being one of the members of the suicide squad. But fortunately, I think it never came off.
So during the demonstration, you'd just be watching?
I was just watching, yes.
Would there just be the one man, the driver, in the tank, or the driver and his gearsman in the tank, or would they have a full crew in as they demonstrated this? Because it does sound very dangerous.
I think only the driver, probably the officer, because of the braking problem. That would be all.
Did they all manage it, or was it just practice with
one? I only saw one do it, but others may have done it, or it may have been called off before any others got a chance.
What were the landing craft like? That's an interesting point.
I never saw the landing craft. I never saw the demonstration on the beach, because it was in enemy territory. The nearest we could get to it was doing it on dry land. As I said, it was a mock-up at Erin, where I saw this concrete.
Sorry, of course.
Concrete,
yes.
Warning.
Were you enthusiastic about the prospect of being in this special?
Well, I was bubbling over with enthusiasm. I thought it was a marvellous thing. Again, with all the futility of one's feelings at the time, we thought it would be the end of the war and so on. Of course, it never was. One didn't realise that at the time.
And it was. Do you know why it was cancelled at all? Did you ever hear?
I think it was cancelled because Haig's attack at Ypres and Passchendaele failed, and the idea was for this to come in at the same time. It was no good putting in this attack on the sea coast, a flank attack, if it wasn't going to be met with an attack from the front proper.